You're listening to the Future Tech Podcast with Richard Jacobs. Future technologies such as artificial intelligence, stem cells, 3D printing, gene editing, Bitcoin, blockchain, the microbiome, quantum computing, virtual reality, and exploring space are much closer than you might think. In fact, many early versions of these technologies are in play right now, and the companies that are using these technologies are the focus of this podcast. My goal for you, the listener, is to learn from these podcasts. You may very well learn something that may change the course of your life for the better, steer you towards a new career, or give you insight into addressing a thorny medical problem. Remember, this podcast and its content is informational in nature only. No medical, tax, legal, financial, or psychological advice is being given. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please listen, subscribe, like, and tell your friends about it. Thank you. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Future Tech and Future Tech Health podcast. I have Dr. Puya Bashevan, postdoc at MIT, and we're going to be talking about artificial neural networks that can be used to drive and model brain activity. So, Puya, thank you for coming.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, when we talk about modeling brain activity, what facet of brain activity? Is it just the visual cortex, or is it other kinds of brain activity? Like, what's the focus of your work?
In general, my work, as well as the lab that I worked with Jim DiCarlo at MIT, we're mainly focused on how our brain sees. It's mainly engaged in the visual cortex and the way it recognizes objects.
Okay, so we're trying to model how humans recognize objects?
Yes. Mostly about how humans perceive objects and try to basically model the computations and the algorithms that our brain uses to do so.
What are some objects that people seem to model and perceive instantly? Mm-hmm. Which ones do we have trouble with? And then same with computers.
Yeah, one remarkable and interesting fact about humans is that we can recognize maybe tens of thousands of objects very quickly within tens of milliseconds. And some objects that are more common or are more relevant to our usual behavioral goals in everyday life, they basically are represented in our brain with a larger population of neurons. For example, from previous literature, we know about they're called patches, different patches in the brain. For example, there's a patch in human brain that most of the neurons are highly responding to faces, for example. They're called face patches. Or we think in general that the brain as a whole, like the visual cortex, it makes a framework, an infrastructure for us, if you will, that helps us to be able to recognize not only specific objects, but like any object that could be represented by the same set of neurons.
Have we been able to tap into visual processing in different stages as it happens, let's say in a rat or in even in a person, to see what, we've seen, I guess, the different hidden layers of a neural network and the images that they seem to be composing. But have we been able to do that with a live brain?
Mm-hmm. I guess if I understand your question correctly, you're asking, how do we compare the models with the brain, right?
Yeah, have we been able to see any intermediate processing steps of the visual cortex in any living creature?
Yeah. So the core of our research is about that fact. It's about how the internals of our model that we develop or we use from other labs, how similar they are to the neural activity that are happening at different stages of processing in the brain. Right. So, for example, if you take a primate brain, like a monkey's brain or human brain, when a visual stimulus is shown to the animal, its image is reflected on the back of the eye, that is called the retina, and then that signal is transformed into a signal that is an electrical signal, and it's then transported to the cortex, first to the thalamus and then to the cortex, and then once it enters the cortex, there are several layers of processing that happen on that signal, so that it enables us to say what we saw, what object, for example, we saw, right? And the types of models, in particular, artificial neural networks, a class of them called convolutional neural networks, that are currently our best models of these neural processing in the brain, they somewhat have a similar structure. They're not completely the same. They are some approximation of some of these neural mechanisms in the brain, but they also have like several layers. They have different layers of processing that act on the output of the previous layers. So what we do, the core of what we do, the research we do, is try to first of all build and develop better models that could approximate the neural functions and the responses in the brain more accurately. And then second of all, to find ways, better ways that we can compare between them, compare the how similar these responses are.
Well, how do we know that we're modeling any particular brain accurately? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, so we use machine learning tools for doing so. Just to give you an example of how do we quantify basically how good our models are. We bring in a set of visual stimuli, a set of natural images, for example, like image of a dog, image of a face, image of a cat, image of a chair, and then we show these images to a monkey, for example, as we are recording neural responses from different parts of the brain from the animal. And we can now show the same set of images to our computational model, these artificial neural networks in our case. And then because these models, we've built them, we have access to their internals, basically the equal of neurons in the brain in our model that we call the model unit, right? And then we go inside our models, and then we try to find these units in our model that the way that they respond to all of these visual stimuli is very similar to the way that these neurons that we're recording from the brain, right? If I want to be more technical, for example, you can represent the activity that a neuron, that the way that a neuron responds to different visual stimuli as a vector, and usually the response of an individual neuron is encapsulated as one number that is the firing rate, how many spikes it would generate after seeing a visual stimulus. And then we try to find these units in the model that produce the same set of activities, similar set of activities to what the neuron is telling us.
This may be weird, but is there any difference between, you know, sending a file or a neural network accessing a file that has an image on it versus literally holding up an image to a camera that connects to a computer that has a neural network in it? Because we see literally by, you know, the photons of light entering our eye, computer networks seem to see by, you know, you send it a file or it looks at a file of data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're asking, the question that you're asking is a very good one. But there are differences at different levels, right? There are different levels of processing. For example, we have one level, we just care about what algorithm is being done, what type of computation is being done on that input, and how different is that computation that is done using a neural network in the brain and an approximation that is done using an artificial neural network in the computer, right? The focus of my research is mostly on these computations, but we should not forget that there are also like these lower level mechanistic differences, the way that the brain is wired, the way that the biology works, like using neurons, different types of neurons, right? And they're fundamentally different, as we know, from how computers run, right? You have a CPU, for example, a central processing unit in the computer. So there are these differences at different levels, but what we're hoping to achieve is to better approximate the function and the computation in the computer. And we have come very far since we started to study the brain, but we're still very far in modeling these neural processing in the brain at the level of accuracy that we can confidently say we know what the brain is doing, what these circuits in the brain are doing after seeing a visual stimulus, for example.
So far, what are neural networks that are emulating vision good at, and where are they lacking?
Yeah, so already there are many types of neural networks that are coming from mostly from machine learning community that they can accomplish tasks like recognizing different objects from static visual stimuli, or to some degree to recognize what types of actions are happening in the short snippets of videos. Or in some cases, like they're able to recognize like what is the scene, for example, that you're looking at, not specific to an individual object. For example, if the scene is coming from a kitchen or is like a train station, things like this. And also, like there are different challenges that machine learning scientists that are working on vision problems are engaged with. And one of the most the challenge is now being pushed towards like the problems that require multiple modalities of data. For example, visual question answering. If you're shown an image, if you're shown a picture, and then if you're asked a question about that picture, how well would you be able to answer that question? For example, is someone doing something funny in this picture, for example, right? Or where do you think, like, if there is a picture of a car, like going to turn to the left, like would you be able to infer that where the car is going to go next or not? Things like this are becoming the next challenges for machine learning and artificial intelligence to solve.
Yeah, that sounds much higher level. Interesting. Where do you think the most difficult application of machine vision is right now? Is it a self-driving car? Is it in other applications? What do you think?
Yeah, definitely self-driving cars are currently one of the most challenging applications of vision. Of course, there are many branches in the industry that depend on having a very good visual system. For example, robotics. If you want to have robots that could do jobs as well as humans, for example, like if whether they are types of robots that build cars, for example, or assistant robots that can help us with everyday life, vision is a necessary module, if you will, in their operating. That unless they have a very good vision model, they would not be able to do many of these tasks that we want to ask them to do, right? But I think right now I can think of these two, but I'm sure like there are many more examples of this. And there are many people from many different fields that are now kind of trying to get the machine learning and combine with their own field of research and to come up with new problems for both their field and machine learning to be solved.
Are there any emergent properties of machine vision that you've seen? Or is the goal just to get it to the level of human vision and it's good enough? Or do we want to take it beyond there?
Yeah, I think the challenge is mostly about what the algorithm is. When we figure out what the algorithm is for learning good representations of visual information that we are exposed to, I think at that point, you're not necessarily tied to how good the human vision would be, right? Because now human vision is at least partly is dependent on the resources that is available to it. The resources being the neurons and the specific architecture of the brain, the connection between these neurons. But if we figure out like how the algorithm that these circuits are using to learn new visual representations, then we should be able to extrapolate them by giving them even more resources. Or, for example, you can think that if you think of the human eye or the retina at the back of the eye as the lens or the front part of the camera that basically senses the light from outside world, the least that we can do is to allow an artificial vision system to have an even higher resolution camera at the input. And that on its own could enable artificial vision to be operating even better than how human vision would operate.
Oh, you mean having an AI system using a gigapixel camera or a super high resolution camera to do the initial scene?
Exactly. That's like a very naive example, but that's the first thing that you can do with an artificial vision that algorithmically or computationally does as good as humans. that's one step that you can push it even further beyond human vision.
Well, I guess the interesting thing you can do with machine vision is that you can see what the machine is seeing as well at the same time, right?
Right. Of course, it depends on how interpretable that machine vision is, right? And that's another interesting domain of like research in machine learning and in vision research that focuses on making these algorithms, these models, these networks to be more interpretable, so that it would be easier for us to understand what's happening in these models.
Okay, makes sense. What about machine vision? Is it using infrared? Is it using UV? Any other parts of the spectrum that we can't normally see?
Can it see a finer resolution
of certain wavelengths than we can see?
Right, that's kind of related to the example that I gave earlier. Like I was thinking of like a higher resolution sensor in the input, but your question is going to the same direction, thinking that what if we had like other additional sensors in the input that would basically make the range of frequencies that we could observe wider, right? Like infrared or ultraviolet, these are like two different frequencies. Of course, again, it depends on how good we can approximate the computations that are done in the brain. If we can figure out those computations, those algorithms, there is the potential that we can apply the same type of computation to new inputs, new types of inputs, like the infrared camera, for example, to try to learn useful information from these coming signals that could help us with doing a specific behavior. Whether like we can think of a range of behaviors. For example, for infrared, there is an evidence example, and that is like you would be able to see in the dark, be better in the dark, right? So in principle, that is possible, and I'm sure people, other research groups are already working on these, and that these are very exciting and interesting.
So what are some of the particulars of your research? What are you narrowly focused on right now?
So my main research goals are. At the time are mostly focused on vision, human vision, and trying to build and improve our current models for primate vision in general. And in particular, what I have been working on, what I've been focused on, is to try to use these models to manipulate the neural activity in the brain, kind of like giving us a tool so that we can use it to better understand the brain. And of course, to be able to set the brain state into a desired state. So far, what we've been doing was mostly a proof of concept of something that kind of looks like this. But we're hoping that we would be pushing this forward beyond sensory cortices, because that's basically where we applied our technique. We used a neural network to try to induce a desired neural pattern of activity in the visual cortex, right? But in a longer domain, like a vision and for the future, we think that if you have good models of higher cognitive areas, higher cognitive functions in the brain, we should in principle be able to do a similar thing to the higher level functions, right? For example, if you have a good memory, if you have a good model of memory or a good model of how we react emotionally to visual stimuli, we should be able to now have some level of control over emotions in our brain, right? And that could lead to potential applications that I want to think that could be used for treating some brain disorders. For example, if you have some patients with a specific disorder, if you can define their problem as a control problem, if you wish, that, for example, we know that the brain response, normal brain response to a visual stimulus should be like pattern A, but we have a person with a particular disorder that is showing an irregular pattern of activity. And then using these type of models, we're hoping that we would be able to change the pattern of activity in the disorder case to be more like the normal case, the pattern that we expect to be emerging in the brain. Hope that is clear. I don't know if
I understand. Well, it seems like, you know, for people, they don't have, they can't discriminate everything that they see. You know, like if if I'm a man, I never look at like women's purses. I literally probably don't even see them. I just filter them out, you know. or if I'm not an x-ray technician, I can't interpret x-rays when I see them. I literally don't know what I'm seeing. So it seems like machine vision will have to be an amalgamation of, I don't know, dozens or hundreds of different tuned neural networks that perceive certain objects better than others, and all of them together maybe may go into a machine vision system that's robust. This is my guess. Or is it we're trying to get one system, one neural network, to be able to see all kinds of objects?
I see. Let me first see if I understand your question clearly. You're asking whether if we cannot name an object, we cannot see that object. For example, if I don't know what a woman's purse looks like, I can still describe it to you, right? So I can see it, but maybe I don't know the word to tell you what I'm seeing, right? But you're still seeing it.
Right, but you know, with people, there's definitely a learning curve for things that we don't normally see. So is it too much to expect one gigantic, you know, 8 million layer neural network, for instance, to be able to process thousands of different types of images in the visual field? You know, or we have to string together many very narrow select, you know, machine vision applications to make one that would work on many objects.
I think I got your question. So the learning that you're talking about and the time that it takes for us to be able to recognize these objects, part of this training is not necessarily the way that we perceive these objects. It could be more related to we see the object, we can still describe the object. We need to remember what to call the object, right? For example, to call this notebook in front of me as a notebook or a phone, if I have never seen a phone. So that next time I see a phone in a different pose, a different angle, a different size, different types of it, I could still be able to call it a phone, right? But we believe that the part of this network, the part of the brain that the rest of the brain uses to perceive and name objects is common to a large degree. And it's basically trained throughout lifetime. And most of the training is done very early during development. And to answer your question that you said, whether we should expect a single neural network to be able to recognize all of these objects all together within the same network, or whether we should have smaller and more specialized neural networks that together gives us the ability to recognize all of these objects. This is my opinion, but I would put my bet on having a very large neural network that does the job for everything we need to do, rather than focusing on specialized microcircuits that we can put together and get to our function. Of course, some of this might have been done during evolutionarily, like as humans were developing throughout ages. But I think the best bet right now would be to try to focus on a single larger neural network that could get us to our goals, basically enabling us to do the behaviors that we desire to do or we are forced to do because of the environment.
So how good are some of the top systems out there if you compare them to you know, how people can see? In certain fields, I've heard they're excelling, in certain fields not. So what's the state of the art from your perspective?
Yeah, there are many, and now we have many good models that can do a wide range of tasks that maybe not a long time ago, we only thought that humans would be able to. Like, for instance, even the object categorization, saying what object exists in an image, was not possible by maybe even a decade ago, right? But now they're doing all kind of stuff. They're being used in autonomous driving. They're not still as robust, as reliable as humans, but they've come a long way since maybe a decade ago. But I think that one of the main problems with current machine learning tools and machine learning models is that they're not reliable enough. They can do good on, for example, on smaller data sets that the stimuli, for example, in image categorization, that the images in those data sets are controlled. They're controlled to be natural. They're controlled for the objects to be in specific poses. Like, we don't normally see objects that are in weird shapes or weird poses, right? But as humans or as primates, we are very robust to many, many ways that we can see these objects. For example, you can imagine that we are very good at recognizing different objects under different light conditions. in many cases, we can even recognize what objects in front of us, even if we show, if we see a shadow of that object, right? So some of, basically what the point that I want to make is that we are, our recognition systems, our vision is more reliable. It, we can rely on it. We can depend on it in a wider range, right? Wider range of applications, wider range of environments, like conditions, whether they are conditions like lighting or pose, or it could be relevant to like what context we're seeing, right? So some of this also could be because of so much experience that we gather throughout our lifetime, that a lot of these models, even though they're being trained on many millions of images, it might not be comparable to the level of experience that humans are exposed to.
Are you able to, you know, to train systems so they can interpret shadows of things? Or, I mean, is any of that even useful? You know, like I could tell you there's a cat up in the tree, or an upside down cat, or the shadow of a cat, or a cat playing piano wearing a suit. But is that useful?
I'm thinking the reason I talked about that was not just to suggest that we should be doing only on shadows of objects, but training these networks to be able to recognize, for if we talk about only object recognition for simplicity, if we allow these networks to be exposed to many different conditions, including being able to recognize objects, not by seeing the objects, but by seeing the shadows of those objects, it could help us to get to better, more reliable models of what's happening in the brain. So that, for example, if you're going to use this vision system in an autonomous car and the car is driving at night, maybe even before a pedestrian starts walking across the street, even if we see that our vision system, our machine vision system, sees the shadow of that person being reflected on the road, it would be able to now predict that there is a person there, and it should try to break before it gets that person.
Okay, very good, makes sense. So what's ahead in the next couple of years in machine vision? What do you think is going to be possible?
I think there is now a lot of push towards now putting these vision systems in even larger models that are being trained to do more complex and more realistic types of behaviors. By that, I mean like going beyond object recognition or scene segmentation or scene understanding, just going directly to the types of behaviors that us as humans or primates are able to do. For example, like surviving in an environment, right? And then develop these vision systems as part of that bigger model that is being trained on doing a more realistic task, right? Like, for example, a set of experiments or a set of the models that are being trained, of course, these are toy examples, but these include the models that are being trained to be able to play different games, right? Right now, a lot of research is being done for these models to be able to play Atari games. But you can also imagine that given the progress in virtual systems and game engines, we might be able to sometime in the near future to scale up these games to more realistic types of games that could better approximate the types of experience that our vision system or even our brain is exposed to during a lifetime. For example, imagine that we have a very complex virtual system, like a game engine, a world, if you will, a virtual world, that we can put agents, artificial agents, with artificial brains into these game engines. And then their goal would be to survive for as long as they can. And throughout the process, they would be training different parts of their brain, including their vision system. And then I think it would be very interesting, both from machine learning point of view, as well as brain science and neuroscience point of view, what those brains would end up looking like when they're developed in those kind of environments. Would they become more similar to the brain that we are equipped with? The kind of, if we start recording from internals of those models, how similar would those be to our brain if we record from their neurons?
That makes sense. I guess seeing what playing video games does to machines' brains, just like what it does to our brains. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. Like, basically trying to fill up the gap between the types of experiences primates or humans are exposed to and the types of experiences that the machines are exposed to. Like, fill up the gap, make it more similar as well as we can.
Okay, makes sense. Well, very good. What do you think is possible maybe 20 years out? You know, I'm going way out here, but what do you think is going to be the outer edge of possibility for machine vision, let's say, in 20 years?
Of course, the possibilities are, like, unlimited. But in relation to brain and neuroscience, I can say most in that direction. Like, right now, there are three main bottlenecks that are kind of preventing us getting closer to understanding the brain and making these models more similar to the brain. And those are one, how good we can record from the brain. Second is like how good we can approximate the function in the brain. And thirdly, how good we can act on the brain. I'm hoping in the next 20 years, we would have a lot of progress in all three areas. Only one of the areas that is actually directly related to your question, which is about what functions are being done in the brain that is related to artificial intelligence and machine learning and vision systems. But I imagine if you ask a machine learning scientist maybe a decade ago, like what to expect in the next 10 years, they wouldn't have been predicting that we're going to have this much progress in the maybe last seven, eight years. So it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. But I think 20 years is a lot of time, and we can hopefully make a lot of progress. I don't know how far we can go and how much more similar to the brain we can have these systems, these models to be. But probably a lot of the tasks that are still being done exclusively by humans, in the next 20 years, many of them will be replaced by machines or could be replaced by machines to some degree.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Puyo, what's the best way for people to get in touch or to ask more questions about your research?
They can look me up online or they can email me. Should I say my email address?
Yeah, it's up to you. They can go to MIT. And are you working under a particular lab name? What's the best place
I work at the Carlo Lab at MIT, so it's pretty easy to find me. You can just Google my name.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Puyo, thank you for coming. I really appreciate your time and everything.
Yeah, glad to talk to you, and thank you for inviting me again.
You're listening to the Future Tech Podcast with Richard Jacobs. Future technologies such as artificial intelligence, stem cells, 3D printing, gene editing, Bitcoin, blockchain, the microbiome, quantum computing, virtual reality, and exploring space are much closer than you might think. In fact, many early versions of these technologies are in play right now, and the companies that are using these technologies are the focus of this podcast. My goal for you, the listener, is to learn from these podcasts. You may very well learn something that may change the course of your life for the better, steer you towards a new career, or give you insight into addressing a thorny medical problem. Remember, this podcast and its content is informational in nature only. No medical, tax, legal, financial, or psychological advice is being given. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please listen, subscribe, like, and tell your friends about it. Thank you.